Excited to be back in Genesis. And yeah, it's exciting, right? It's a good book. It's a very good book to study. Genesis is often the book that I would say is probably most, I shouldn't say most attacked, right? But in terms of when you have more, let's say, liberal scholarship, that's not going to hold to inerrancy, that's not going to hold to the things that we would hold to here. Genesis is oftentimes one of the books that's most attacked. And the foundations that we see, of course, in creation, there's so much to learn from that. Even understanding God as our creator, what does that mean? What are all the ramifications of that? And so there's a great deal to learn, especially from those chapters 1 through 11. We've made a bit of a switch, though, and we're now in the lives of the patriarchs, and we get some really, really interesting glimpses into the lives of these guys. So we're going to take a look. They're going to take a look at Isaac and Jacob today. Also, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about Esau and some interesting people, some interesting decisions that they make, some interesting life choices that they make, and we want to learn more about them. Before we delve into that, though, let me open us first in a word of prayer. Our Father in heaven, Lord, we come before you and we're grateful for your word. We're grateful, Lord, that you are a trustworthy God, that you are faithful, that you do not change. We're thankful, Lord, that we can see your character on display even thousands of years ago because of the word that you have given to us. You deal faithfully with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob. You show mercy and grace and kindness and compassion, and Father, you do the exact same to us today, to those who have faith in Christ. And Father, we pray that you would bless us today, give us insight into your word. Help us, Lord, to bridge the time gap that we have. These events are so long ago, but Father, you are the same God, and we pray that you would help us to understand your character better. Bless our time, Lord. We pray all these things in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right. So as I mentioned before, as we've been going through Genesis, we have, of course, Genesis 1 through 11, and then 12 through 50. That's kind of the two major portions in terms of structure that we have. But then when we're looking at chapters 12 all the way through 50, we see it broken down into roughly three different groups. So we have the life of Abraham, which we looked at last week, and then we have the life of, I'm going to say, Jacob that we're looking at today, and then Joseph after that. Now, Isaac, you say, well, what happened to Isaac? Of course, he's in there, but there's not a lot of attention. There's not a lot of time in terms of number of chapters that's dedicated to Isaac. Okay, so we're going to learn some things about Isaac. I think we can see some really interesting things about his character, even some of his personality coming out. But in terms of the focus of Genesis, you have Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph, and that's all playing a very important role in the structure of Genesis. All right, let's first talk about Isaac, though. Let's first talk about Isaac, and Isaac is, there's a question. We first interacted, of course, with Isaac last week, and we saw not only his promised birth, and God granting Abraham and Sarah the opportunity to have a son. Notice especially that this is not Abraham's only child. Okay, Ishmael as well. Remember the very interesting decision that Sarah made to give Abraham Hagar, and Abraham's like, oh yeah, that's a great idea. Let's go along with that. Not so smart. We're gonna see that happen again in Genesis, and then again in Genesis. And there's a lot of repetition that we see, and I think that that's very intentional. As we're thinking about the movement and the structure of the book, we're going to see some very interesting repetition throughout the book. We want to pay attention to that, especially. So, we were introduced, of course, to Isaac, and we have the offering up of Isaac on Mount Moriah. And Isaac asks a question there, but we're not sure exactly how does he respond. So when his father ties him and binds him and puts him on the offering, you know, on the altar, what does he do? What's he thinking? Is there a discussion that happens there? Is there a struggle that happens there? What exactly does that look like? We're not sure. And that's not really the point of the text. We come to know Isaac a little bit better as the chapters move along, and the next place where we're interacting a good amount with Isaac, though he's not the central focus, is with Isaac and Rebekah. And Abraham is really on display. Rebekah is very much on display in her desire to do what God would have her to do. Okay, her desire to go back with Abraham's servant. And so you have Abraham who's telling his servant, you need to go back and find a wife for Isaac. You need to go back and find a wife for Isaac. Now, why is that important? Throughout Genesis, we're going to see a little bit of a struggle in terms of Abraham, we're separated out. Okay, we're now it's not a Jewish nation yet, okay, but we're distinct. Okay, Abraham was distinct from Sodom and Gomorrah. He chose not to go down into Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot does the opposite, right? And we see suffering and judgment because of that. Okay, things that happened to Lot because of that decision that he made to be synchronistic, right, with the culture around him. We see also that when we move towards the end of Genesis, or even today that we'll look at, we see some not so great decisions about, in particular, Esau choosing a couple of wives for himself from the people right around. Okay, and we're going to see that that doesn't bring a whole lot of joy to Isaac and Rebekah. That's part of the reason that Rebekah says to Isaac, hey, you need to go find a wife for Jacob back in Haran. Okay? Is it that there's no good people in Canaan and that there's better people in Haran? Haran's not necessarily a center of morality, right? It's not exactly a center of great moral teaching or anything like that. We're going to interact a little bit with Laban, right? Laban's not like, he's not a really upstanding guy, but he has his two daughters, of course, Leah and Rachel, and we're going to see their character on display. Okay, so there's a couple of themes that I want us to think about as we go through this section today, but especially I want you to think about character. What's the character of these individuals? What are the decisions that they're making, and is there anything in the text that helps us to understand why they're making a decision that they are? Okay, because certainly not all of their decisions are great. Abraham does not make the best decisions. Isaac does not make the best decisions. He's kind of like a replica of his father. Okay, we're going to see that in a little bit. Jacob does not make great decisions. So we're going to see some issues with character, with their decisions. But then we're going to see some very interesting highlights where God is working with them and God chooses to bless them, even perhaps in spite of the decisions that they're making, okay, in spite of those things. Why? The whole focus of Genesis is on the covenant that I made with Abraham. Okay, I will be faithful to Abraham, to his offspring. Why? Because I said I was going to be. Okay. The promise that God made to Abraham is at the central focus here. All right, let's talk about Isaac, and actually we're first going to talk about this relationship between Isaac and Rebekah. So we have quite a few chapters to go through, so I'm going to pull out some particular key texts, and we won't be able to, of course, read through all of it, not nearly. But we have Sarah, Abraham's wife, who dies in chapter 23, and then it's after that point, okay, after Sarah dies, that Abraham is saying to his servant, okay, we need to find a wife for my son, for Isaac. Okay, we need to find a wife for Isaac. Very interesting also, in terms of Abraham and Sarah, if you turn to Genesis 25:1, now, Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimron, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, Shua. Gives a whole list. And you're like, that's really interesting. Sarah dies, and then Abraham takes to himself another wife after that. And the term here is another wife in verse 1. You have Abraham who has had children with Hagar, one child, with Sarah, and now with Keturah. So Abraham has quite a few children, right? Quite a few children. All of his children born to him after he's 90 years old or more. But I want you to pay attention to, let's say, that chapter 25, verse 5. And Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living. And you say, concubines? What do you mean? Verse 1 just said Keturah is his wife, right? Just said Keturah is his wife. But then it calls her and Hagar concubine after that? How is that the case? Okay, to the sons of the concubines, so that would include Ishmael, and that's going to include the children that he just had with Keturah. So Abraham gave them great gifts. Okay, he's a rich man by the time that he goes to die. He's a very wealthy man, and he gives gifts to all of his children, but the inheritance only goes to Isaac. Only goes to Isaac. Is that a wise decision to make? Is that not a wise decision to make? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Okay, keep that in the back of your mind as we talk about Isaac in a sense, Isaac's personality that's going to come through. Okay, but it's very interesting to me that 25:6 says concubines. Why? Why would that be the case? Why call Keturah? There's nothing wrong with Keturah here. She didn't do anything wrong in the text. Okay, why put her in that category? Why do that? The promise to Isaac is being elevated. Abraham, God comes, gives a promise to Abraham. Abraham acts in faith and steps out from his home country and goes as he's supposed to do. Along the way, he makes some really not so good decisions, causes a lot of problems in his life and the life of others. But Abraham is, or God is still faithful to his promise with Abraham. God says, I will give you and Sarah a child, the two of you specifically, I will give you a child, and that child is whom the promise is going to continue on with, okay? And Paul, of course, is going to pull on this. He's going to pull on this in Romans, and he's going to pull on this in Galatians, both of them, saying that there's a child of the promise. Very, very important. Very important, okay? The line that we have, and the way that the promise is coming about, God is saying, I will work in a particular way to bring about my promise through a particular line. And in a sense, we can kind of view the whole of Genesis, the rest of Genesis, is focusing down on this promise. We have Abraham first, then we have Isaac, then we have Jacob, then we have Joseph, and an emphasis on Judah at the end. We're going to see next week. Okay, so it's focusing down on God bringing his promise. We should also remember that when God is bringing his promise, it's not just, hey, I'm deciding to choose Abraham and everybody else can, you know, forget about everybody else, right? I'm only ever going to work with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their descendants. I'm only ever going to work with them anymore. I'm done with everybody else. That is not the way that the promise was made. Why? Because the promise given to Abraham is you're going to be a blessing to all the nations. A blessing to all the nations. Even though there's a specific focus that's put upon Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the whole point is that it's a blessing to all the nations. We'll see that as well as we go through. Even, let's say, the genealogy here in chapter 25 of Ishmael. Okay, so God gave promise to Hagar and Ishmael as well. God said, Ishmael is going to be this. Okay, gave description of what he's going to be like, what he's going to do. Okay, God didn't let them die. Remember, Hagar was cast out, and God provided for Hagar, provided for Ishmael. And you have a generations of Ishmael in chapter 25, starting in verse 12. Why give the generations of Ishmael? It's got nothing to do with the promise. Okay, it's not specifically focusing in on the promise. The same thing will happen to Esau. Okay, why give the generations of Esau? Why is that necessary? Why is that helpful at all? Okay, we see glimpses in Genesis of God working, or the focus is on the promise, but the promise is bringing the blessing, okay, to all nations. Okay, so when we look at the emphasis that's placed upon Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, don't mistakenly think that God has just selected one group of people and he's like, I'm done with everybody else now, okay? That is not the case. All right, let's go back to talk about God's blessing for Isaac with Rebecca. We could spend a lot of time on Isaac and Rebecca. We could do a whole case study on marriage and maybe good things to do in your marriage, not so good things to do in your marriage. But we won't have time for all of that. We're gonna come to another case study when we get to Jacob and Leah and Rachel, what not to do in your marriage, and maybe what to do in your marriage. More of the not, probably, than what you should do. But a wife for Isaac, Abraham sends his servant and says, go back, collect a wife, find a wife from our kin for my son, for Isaac. And there is a beautiful story about how God sovereignly works in order that Rebecca is identified. Okay, and we won't go into all of those details. But Rebecca, not only there and identified and then asked, would you come back? Okay, but she has a brother whose name is Laban. And we start to get to know Laban. Chapter 24, verse 29, we start to get to know Laban a little bit. What kind of a man is he? Because later on, of course, Jacob is going to have a lot of interaction with Laban, and very, very little of it is going to be positive. Okay, so they ask Rebecca, are you willing to come back? And she says, yes. Verse 60 of chapter 24, they blessed Rebekah and said to her, may you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s. May your seed possess the gate of those who hate him. Then Rebekah arose with her young women. They mounted camels and went after the man, or they followed after the servant, and the servant took Rebekah and went. Okay, and verse 67 as well. Take a look at Isaac. This is a very interesting passage, that verse. Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah. She became his wife, and he loved her. Thus, Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. It's a beautiful picture, okay? The way that God has designed things to be. Okay, so that's initially, there's a really beautiful picture of the marriage that they have. Starts out in a really good way. In a really beneficial way. And I appreciate that the text puts in that he loved her. Okay, that's encouraging. That's a good thing. Turn over to Genesis 26. Take a look at verse 7. So Isaac lived in Gerar. Then the men of the place asked about his wife. And he said, she's my sister. For he was afraid to say, my wife, thinking lest the men of the place kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful in appearance. Where have we heard this before? Where do we get this before? Twice with Abraham. Okay, and Isaac does not fall far from the tree. So he lives in Gerar and somehow thinks that they're not going to kill me and take my wife if we pretend to be brother and sister. What's going to happen to my wife? Right? Why are we pretending to be brother and sister? so that the people who are there don't think, oh, I have to kill Isaac in order to get Rebecca. Okay, so we're brother and sister, so then what happens to my wife, right? She's up for grabs, right? She's, hey, you wanna marry her? Like, what kind of a person is going to say that? What kind of a husband is going to do that? Like, he's planning on being in Gerar. It's not like he's passing through for just a day, and he's like, okay, my sister, let's get out of here. They're living there. And they live there to such an extent that Abimelech, probably a title here, means my father is king. Abimelech sees Isaac and Rebecca together. And the text says that like they were hugging each other or something like that. He sees it and he's like, oh, she's your wife, right? And he points it out and he says, well, why did you lie to us? Why did you lie to us? And Isaac, you know, oh, I was afraid. I didn't know what to do. And then Abimelech does what's right. Look at verse 11, 26:11. So Abimelech commanded all the people, saying, he who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. Abimelech, a Gentile, has the decency, has the godliness, has the right thinking, at least, to say, all right, let me put out a stipulation, do not touch this man's wife. Isaac didn't even ask for it. Isaac was found out. He was found and caught in his lie, and he's like, well, I was afraid, I didn't know what to do. And Abimelech gives the command. Abimelech says, all right, all the people around here, no. This is Rebecca, she's the wife of Isaac, do not touch her. Okay? Like, that's what Isaac should have done in the first place. It's not as though Isaac doesn't have wealth. It's not as though he doesn't have power. Isaac is quite a wealthy person at this point. Remember that his father goes on a military campaign when Lot is captured with 318 soldiers and takes back all of the wealth that was captured by a whole bunch of kings that came to Sodom and Gomorrah. Isaac's inherited that. We don't know how many people that he has in his household. We don't know how many servants he has. We don't know how much wealth that he has, but it calls him a very wealthy person, and he has people that are surrounding him. Okay? He's not just him and his wife in a tent trying to make their way through life. He's very wealthy. And there's this contrast comparison, Isaac and Abimelech. Isaac just does what his father did. He makes the same wrong decisions that his father did, and Abimelech has the sense to give the right command, the right stipulation. Do not touch Rebekah. So we have a very negative thing in terms of how Isaac treats Rebecca in that instance. Let me give another positive. So we kind of go back and forth between positives and negatives. In chapter 24, verse 67, it says that Isaac loved her and he was comforted after his mother's death. Okay. Chapter 25, let's say 20, Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. Okay, so he's been in bachelorhood for a while. Isaac entreated Yahweh on behalf of his wife because she was barren. So there's this blessing that goes out after Rebekah. She leaves her home, and her brother and those around her say, let's bless you. May you be the mother of thousands of 10,000s. And it just so happens that she's barren for quite some time. In fact, it says that Jacob and Esau are born when Isaac is 60, when he's 60 years old. So she's barren for 20 years. Rebecca is barren for 20 years, and Isaac entreats Yahweh and pleads to Yahweh on behalf of his wife. And it says, and Yahweh was moved by his entreaty. So Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Okay, not only conceived, but conceived twins, right? Jacob and Esau. Be careful what you ask for. Okay, the children struggled within her, and she said, why is it this way? She inquired of Yahweh, and verse 23, Yahweh responds to her and says, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples will be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. And this sets up a whole line of stories between Jacob and Esau from this point. So Isaac, I want to give a little bit of a timeline for Isaac. Okay, this will help us with Jacob and Esau as well. But I want to give a little bit of a timeline for Isaac. What years, that how old was he when certain things happened? Okay, to kind of trace some of these things out. Something really interesting happens with Isaac that I think gives us a little bit of insight into his personality. We've already seen that he lied, just like his father, because he was afraid. Okay, so he put his wife into harm's way in order to save his own skin. We do see that it says that he loved Rebekah, and that also that he entreated Yahweh on her behalf because she was barren. Isaac is a wealthy man. He's a rich man. He's probably a fairly powerful man as well. In Genesis 35, 28, it says that Isaac lives a total of 180 years. Okay, 180 years in total. He's 40 years old when he marries Rebekah. He's 60 when Jacob and Esau are born. Okay, those 20 years that Rebekah is barren. He's 100 years old when Esau gets married. Okay, so Esau gets married first, of course, before Jacob. And let's take a look at chapter 6, verse 34. Okay, Genesis 26, 34. Esau was 40 years old. He took as a wife Judith, the daughter of Beri the Hittite, and also Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. Two Hittites that would have been from the north. Okay, but verse 35, not the thing that you want to have happen as a parent. They brought bitterness to Isaac and Rebekah, to both of them. Brought bitterness to them, made their lives bitter, caused them problems. Okay, it doesn't give a lot more description about that. Why was that causing bitterness? Why was that an issue? But these are not good women. And Esau's not making a real wise decision with these two women. Yes, sir.
Is there a sense like where Isaac, you know, his brother marries?
Yeah.
He's obedient.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, okay, dad's telling me to go there.
Yeah.
I'm going there.
Yeah.
I've married this woman. She hasn't provided me with any heir sons for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain sense to me that he's doing what he should do.
Sure. Yeah. 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 Isaac follows after his father. I'll give you kind of like my feel for Isaac, which this is very open to interpretation. My feel for the kind of person that Isaac is he's a little bit more passive. He's not like out front leader. Let me tell you how it is. Let's do this. He's just a little bit more passive. And they, of course, have their favorites, right? So Rebekah has her favorite of Jacob. And Isaac has his favorite of Esau, maybe because he's firstborn, whatever reason that it is, they're favorites. But I think Isaac is viewed in a very passive way. He's not stepping out. There's a couple of good instances, like positive things happen, but he's not one who's like stepping out in faith and, you know, doing what he's supposed to do, right? So he's 60 years old. When Jacob and Esau are born, he's 100 years old when Esau gets married. Okay, so he's now been married for 60 years. Okay, he's been married to Rebekah for 60 years by the time that Esau gets married. He's 137 years old when Jacob flees. 137 years old when Jacob flees. Jacob flees when he's 77 years old, right? And we're able to piece this together and calculate it because of the age of Joseph. So we get really close to the time frame that Jacob, when Jacob leaves, when he comes back, that kind of a thing. Yeah. Question? Yeah. Right. Yeah. So that passage in Genesis 6, it says mankind will be 120 years now. I take that not as like the lifespan of a man will be 120, but from the time that God says that, the time that he makes that declaration, there's 120 years until the flood comes. Yeah. Because, I mean, generally, like nowadays, people don't usually live past 120. There was I forget her name, but a few years ago, right, a French woman died at 122 years old, and that passage came up again, right? Because the traditional way of interpreting Genesis 6 is to say, like, no one will ever live past 120 years. It goes down, so it's going to go down. By the time we get to Jacob, Jacob comes to Pharaoh in Egypt, and Pharaoh says, Jacob, you are such an old person, you're such an old man, and he's a ways past 120 at that point. And so Pharaoh is viewing it like, wow, you're very old. Jacob says, this is nothing. Like, take a look at my father, take a look at Abraham, take a look at before. But the ages are descending, certainly. Okay. What's interesting to me in terms of the ages that we have is how long or how old people are when certain things happen, right? I always used to think when I was younger, Jacob, like he's like in his what, late teens, early 20s when he flees, right? He's 77 years old. He's been living at home 77 years before he leaves home. I was going to make a joke about Gen Z, and I'm not going to do that. Okay, so remember the story, or just let me give a... So Jacob is 77 when he flees to Laban. Jacob is with Laban for 20 years, so by the time Jacob comes back, he's 97 years old. Okay, he gets married. Jacob would have got married to Leah first, then Rachel when he's 80 years old, okay? Married when he's 80 years old, or excuse me, 84, okay? I'm a seminary professor. Math is not my strong suit. Okay, so 20 years that Jacob is with Laban. Remember the story that we have of why Jacob flees, right? He deceives his father. His father gives him the blessing instead of Esau. Esau says, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to wait until the period of mourning for my father is over, and then I'm going to kill my brother. Okay, Rebekah hears about this and sends Jacob away, or convinces Isaac to send Jacob away. Okay, but I want you to, we're still in terms of Isaac, okay, still in terms of Isaac. Why does Isaac want to bless Jacob or bless Esau at the point that he does? Right? Because he says, I'm almost dead. Right? I'm almost ready to die. It says that his eyesight was failing. Okay, but he says, my son, I think this is the end. I think this is the end, and so I want you to go out like a last meal sort of a thing, right? Go out to the field. Get the game that I like, go hunting, and prepare it the way that I like it, and you feed it to me, or I'll eat it, and then I'm going to die, right? And I think Isaac, hypochondriac is not like that's more of like a modern idea, okay? But when after Jacob eats that meal, he would have lived for another like 43 years, okay? So his eyesight is, you know, not great, okay? Obviously, his eyesight's not great. He's not able to discern, okay, this is Jacob, this is Esau. He has to touch him and feel the hair on his arms. Okay, his hearing is okay because he said, you don't sound like Esau, right? But he lives for another 43 years after Jacob flees. Jacob comes back, and he's still alive after Jacob comes back for another 23 years. Okay, so Isaac, maybe a little bit of a hypochondriac. Okay, who knows? Again, we're trying to piece together what's he like? What's his personality like? The description of Isaac and Rebekah, when we get to this portion, where they now have favorites. Jacob is Rebekah's favorite, and Esau is Isaac's favorite. We see that there's this division, right, between them. She has to go and convince him, send Jacob away, right? And she is included in this whole arrangement to trick Isaac. So she overhears Esau, and she's the one who gives Jacob the idea, hey, we need to trick dad, dear old dad, into giving you the blessing instead. Okay, so there's some, let's just say, some marital issues with Rebekah and Isaac. Okay. Let's turn really quick to Esau and chat about Esau for a little bit. We know that Esau takes the stew, we'll come to that in a second. He takes the two wives, okay, at the very end of chapter 26. But before that, Genesis 25, starting in verse 27, he sells his birthright. And we talked a little bit about this before in a couple of sessions before, where it's interesting to us that he gets mad about his birthright, right? He comes in, he's hungry, and Jacob's cooking something on the stove, and he's like, I'm going to die of hunger. And Jacob says, okay, I'll give you some stew. You want some stew? Give me your birthright. What's the birthright? A double portion. Okay, so the inheritance, we have two sons. The inheritance is divided up by thirds. Jacob gets a third. The birthright means that Esau gets two-thirds of the inheritance. This is tangible money. This is, here's three sheep, you get that one, I get these two. Okay, this is tangible wealth, and he sells it for a bowl of stew. Okay, I really like how, I have the LSB here, I like how it translates verse 30 of chapter 25, chapter 25, verse 30, then Esau said to Jacob, please give me a swallow from the red stuff. This red stuff, for I am famished. Therefore, his name was called Edom. Edom having to do with red. Jacob said, first sell me your birthright. Listen to Esau's words. Behold, I am about to die. So of what use then is a birthright to me? I'm about to die. Like, I can't go over to the fridge and get my own food. I'm about to die. You need to feed me. Okay, and he sold it off to him. The very, very important in terms of Esau's character, the very end of chapter 25, it says that Esau despised his birthright. I'm going to turn over to Hebrews chapter 12. We're going to go to the New Testament just for a second here. Hebrews 12, verse 16. Very interesting what the author of Hebrews does here in illustrating Esau. Hebrews 12:16, a command is given that also there be no sexually immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no place for repentance, though he sought it with tears. Esau is not a good character. And the author of Hebrews pulls on a very particular character attribute of Esau that has defined Esau, okay, and how he's being described in Genesis, how Hebrews uses him. This is something that defines Esau. What is it? It's the willingness to sell something of value for something that has no value, but it's immediate. Why does it compare and contrast him with the sexually immoral? Why is that comparison made? Because that's exactly what that is. I am willing to undo my marriage vows. I am willing to give up and sacrifice something that has true, lasting value for a bowl of red stuff. He is the exemplar of those who would trade away something that has true value for something that's immediate gratification. And so Hebrews picks up on this and uses him as the example of that. He's willing to sell it. Sell of something that has value for immediate fulfillment. Okay. So I have Esau, not a good character. Takes two wives for himself. Why? Because he's impulsive. These two women, I want both of them. Let's go get them. I want that bowl of red stuff. Let me have it. What do I got to do to get it? Okay, he's not viewed as a good character. He's impulsive. His father, Isaac, the promise is going through Isaac. Right? So God is promising, I will work with you, Abraham, I will work with you, Isaac. And God, in several instances, reiterates his promise to Isaac and says, just as I promised to your father, just as I promised that it would carry through, this promise would carry through you, so also I'm reiterating to you directly, Isaac, that I will do what I say I'm going to do. Now the promise goes through Jacob. Let's turn our attention to Jacob. The promise goes through Jacob, and of course, Romans is going to pull on this very, very important idea. So Romans chapter 9, very debated passage. The point of Romans 9 is using Jacob and Esau as an example, and it's saying, how is it that this one follows after God and this one doesn't? Everything lies within the decision of God. The point of Romans 9 is to say that it's God's work and it's God's decision. Okay, so before they had done anything good or bad, Romans 9, before Jacob and Esau had done anything good or bad, before Esau took that bowl of stew, before he took those two wives, before Jacob deceived, before anything, it says that Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. Okay, so the promise is going through Jacob. And remember, again, the promise is not just to say, oh, I'm going to work only with these people and everybody else, forget about them. The whole point of the promise is that it's bringing blessing to all the nations. All right, Jacob starts out as a heel grabber. Okay, we all know heel grabber. The name Jacob is coming from that, from heel. Okay, Esau is born first, Jacob born right after, and he comes out holding on to the heel of Esau. He's a manipulator. From the very beginning, he's a manipulator. And we go through and we see all of these different stories of the life of Jacob, all the different ways that he acts, the decisions that he makes. The most focus, the most attention is placed upon Jacob. Okay, it's in terms of Abraham is in focus. Isaac has a little bit of room that's talked about him, some stories. Jacob has quite a bit of space that's dedicated to him. Okay, so he's a heel grabber. He's 77 years old when he leaves. He's married 7 years after that. Okay, so he's 84 when he gets married, he's 97 when he returns. And we have this very interesting relationship between Jacob and Laban. I want to point out, in particular, Jacob as he's traveling, you have Jacob's dream. And there's all kinds of question and debate about what exactly is going on here. So Genesis 28, okay, Genesis 28, Jacob's departing from where they were, from Beersheba. And he's going towards Haran. If you remember that map that we had last time, he's just going straight north. Okay, he's going all the way north up to Haran. He reached a certain place and he spent the night there. Took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. That sounds like a really nice pillow. he had a dream. A ladder stood on the earth with its top touching heaven. Behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. And the land on which you lie, I will give it to you and your seed. Your seed will be like the dust of the earth. You will spread out to the west, to the east, to the north, to the south. In you and your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. All the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you. I will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not forsake you until I have done what I have promised you. Jacob awakes. Notice what Jacob says. I don't want to pull too much on this, but he makes a vow. Verse 20, Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me, will keep me on this journey on which I am going, will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in peace, then Yahweh will be my God. If God does this for me, then Yahweh will be my God. He just had a dream. He just had a vision of God saying, not, hey, Jacob, if you do really good, then I'll bless you. God doesn't say to Jacob, hey, Jacob, I'm gonna give you this vision, and if you only marry one woman and be faithful to her and don't call her your sister when you go to Abimelech, then I'll bless you. It doesn't say that. Okay, he says, I am Yahweh. I will give you this land and to your seed. Your seed will be like the dust of the earth. In you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Behold, I am with you. I will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land. I am Yahweh. I make a promise, I keep it. And I'm choosing to bless you. I'm choosing to do this for you. Jacob says, oh, that's fantastic. That's amazing. That's great. If Yahweh does this, then Yahweh will be my God. You're like, okay. Maybe not the best response, right? Maybe a response more like Mary, when the angel comes to Mary and Joseph, and Mary says, what you have said, let it be to your servant. You said it, God said it, it's done. Right? Jacob has a little bit of a different response. Okay, so he's on his way, and you still see manipulation coming out. He gets to Haran, and he falls in love with Rachel. There's a whole story, we don't have time to go through it right now, but chapter 29, about how he meets Rachel. What happens? He opens the well, the rock from the water, which is apparently a great way to find a spouse, right? Let me just get that huge rock out of your way and move it over here. And Jacob falls in love with Rachel and goes to Laban and says, okay, I want to marry Rachel. What's that going to take? And Jacob meets his match when it comes to Laban in terms of deception. He meets his match. I really wonder what the day-to-day life was like between those two. They're businessmen. They're both businessmen. There's a lot of decisions that need to be made. Okay, this flock needs to go to this pasture. We're going to buy these animals from these people. We're going to use this money for this. They're business partners. Okay, after a while, they become just very much business partners. What did that look like? Laban is, he's a conniver. And you have Leah, and you feel bad for Leah. First of all, it's the night of the wedding. Jacob works for 7 years. Okay, he works for 7 years according to the contract that he made with Laban. Works for 7 years, and he's like, all right, 7 years is up. I want my wife now. I want Rachel. And all that the way that the text describes it is that Laban sends Leah into the tent, and they have their first night, and Jacob doesn't even know it. He doesn't even know it. Like, are we like partaking a little bit too much of the libations? Like, how do you not know that this is Rachel and not, or this is Leah and not Rachel. How is it that you don't know that? But however that it happened, whatever that looked like, he didn't know. And then it says, very interestingly, in chapter 29, verse 25, now it happened in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. It's like this really great sentence. You picture Jacob waking up, and he's like, rolls over, and he's like, oh, it's Leah. Like, what happened here? What's going on? And Leah is blessed by God, in particular because she's unloved by her husband. And you see God showing great kindness to Leah because she's unloved by her husband. So Jacob keeps or stays with Leah, but says, I really want to have Rachel as my wife. And then verse 27, chapter 9, verse 27, he says, fulfill the week of this one, of Leah, and we will give you the other also for the service which you shall serve with me for another 7 years. Okay? So do another 7 years for me. But you have Leah, and then you have Rachel, who's given a week after, and then he just owes those 7 years after that point. Okay, so he serves for another 7 years. Verse 31, Yahweh saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. There's this theme of barrenness that we have throughout Genesis. Sarah, Rebekah, and now Rachel. Leah conceived and bore a son, named him Reuben. And every one of the names that we have for Leah's children is a response. Like, oh, God has seen that my husband doesn't love me. Surely now my husband will love me. She conceived again and bore a son and said, because Yahweh has heard that I am unloved, he has given me another son also. So he named him Simeon. Okay, all of these names that we have to do with the broken relationship between Leah and Jacob. The fractured relationship. So Leah begets Reuben, the firstborn. Okay, and once we start having these children come on the scene, okay, obviously we're moving to the 12 tribes. Okay, it's how are those individuals acting? Okay, how are they acting? What kind of people are they? And just we'll see next week. Not great decisions. It's just a perpetual cycle. Granddad didn't make great decisions. Great-granddad didn't make great decisions. Dad didn't make great decisions. I'm going to follow in my father's footsteps. And it's just a perpetual cycle of unwise, ungodly decisions that are made. And we catch instances, we catch glimpses of God saying, I'm still faithful. I'm still going to keep my promises that I've made to you. And at times we see glimpses of this one acted in faith. This one did what he was supposed to do, but a lot of wrong decisions. So Leah and Rachel, there's a rivalry between them because Rachel is loved, but Leah has children. And so Leah has Reuben, Simeon, Levi, okay, third born is Levi, tribe of Levi, Judah, okay, Judah is coming from Leah. That's very important. Joseph is going to come from Rachel, and Joseph is a very important, very prominent tribe. Okay, it's going to divide into two, Ephraim and Manasseh, because it's so large. Okay, but Judah, the promise, if we're talking about selection, promise, tracing this line down to our Messiah, it's going to go through Leah. Okay, so Leah, fourth born, gives birth to Judah, then Issachar, then Zebulun, and she also has apparently the one daughter. Okay, I feel really bad for this daughter, and it's Dinah. Okay, so the one daughter, Dinah. There may have been more daughters, but at least Dinah's the only one mentioned. Okay, so has quite a few children. Then we have Bilhah and Zilpah. And Bilhah and Zilpah are the two handmaids. Okay, so the daughter, Leah, or Rachel, they get married and they get a handmaid to go with them. Like, this is not a great, it's just not a great role to have in this family. Okay? Why? Because Abraham and Hagar. And just wrong decisions being made there. So Leah and Rachel have Bilhah and Zilpah. And Leah says to Jacob, hey, why don't you take my handmaid and have children through her, and they'll like count as my children, right? And Rachel does the same thing. Rachel does it first because she can't have children. Okay, so Leah has a whole host of children, and then Rachel says, I'm still barren. She even goes to Jacob and says, give me children or I'm going to die. And Jacob says, like, who am I? Like, I can't, like, what am I going to do? What can I do? And Rachel says, well, take my handmaid and have children through her. And Jacob says, no, I learned from my dad. I learned from my dad. I don't want to do that. I've got this crazy uncle who's causing a bunch of problems for us. Don't want to do that. No, he says, okay, great. That sounds like a great idea. Okay, after a while, Leah stops having children, and then she says, well, you take my handmaid. Okay, different handmaid. And Jacob says, oh, great idea. Sure. So Bilhah has Dan and Naphtali, and Zilpah has Gad and Asher. And Rachel has Joseph and Benjamin. Joseph and Benjamin. Okay, and Rachel dies in birth, giving birth to Benjamin. And she names him Ben-Oni, which is son of my suffering. And then Jacob changes the name and says, no, Benjamin, son of my right hand. Okay, so this sets up our story for Joseph being the favorite back in Canaan. We'll get to that next time. But for those references as well, so Jacob accepts Bilhah. So Rachel comes and says, you know, take Bilhah, my handmaid. That's Genesis 3:30. And then Zilpah right after that in Genesis 30, verse 12. Right? So Genesis 30, verse 3 and Genesis 30, verse 12. I want you to turn to Genesis 32. Genesis 32. Jacob flees from Laban. And so Jacob works for 7 years for Leah, unbeknownst to him. He works another 7 years for Rachel. And then after that, he works another 6 years building wealth, basically, with Laban. And Laban recognizes Jacob is blessed by God, so I want him to stay on as a business partner and make a whole bunch of money because he's blessed. And so in total, he's 20 years there. And then Jacob decides it's time to leave. It's time to go. There's a whole story about Laban pursuing Jacob. They're like, are we going to fight? Is this going to be a battle? What's going to happen? And the very interesting portion of the story is Rachel steals Laban's household gods. And steals the household gods, takes them with, because she thinks she's entitled to them. Probably very, you know, made of gold, something like that, expensive. And she's like, I think that I'm entitled to these. So she steals them. Laban pursues and says, who has my household gods? And Jacob, being a fairly brash person, says, whoever, like, we did not do this. Whoever took these, bring them out and we'll kill them. We'll put them to death. He has no idea that Rachel took them. And so Rachel is able to hide them from Laban and keep them hidden, and Laban goes home without his household gods. Why do I point that out? Because they're carrying a bunch of household gods with them, idols with them from this point, okay, and probably even before. But they have idols with them. And the next few stories that we're going to talk about, just keep in the back of your mind, they've got a bunch of idols with them in their caravan as they're going. So Genesis 32, you have Jacob who's going back, and Esau, he's worried that Esau is still going to try to kill him, is still mad at him. And Jacob's coming back with a huge amount of wealth, but he doesn't have an army like Esau has. Esau, over the last 20 years, has developed a whole following of not so great guys that are considered something like an army. Okay, and so Jacob is on his way back, and he is the one who's now at the mercy of Esau. And it's whatever Esau decides to do is going to happen. And Jacob splits up the camps, and he's like, okay, let's put these animals in front. If they're attacked, then this other group can flee and try to run away. So he's trying to divide things up and make it so that he's not going to lose everything, at least. He's going to meet Esau face to face, and he's going to figure out what decision Esau is going to make. Am I going to carry through on my promise to kill Jacob, or I'm going to show mercy to him? And of course, Esau shows mercy to Jacob. But before all of that happens, you have this really interesting account in 32, verse 24, Jacob wrestling with God. And there's all kinds of ideas and commentaries on what exactly is going on here. Jacob was left alone, chapter 32, verse 24. Jacob was left alone after he's divided up his camp, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of dawn. You're like, what is going on, right? It's like a weird change of story, right? Like if you're watching a movie and then suddenly like there's just two guys wrestling in the desert. You're like, what is going on in this movie? Okay, he saw, verse 25, he saw that he had not prevailed against him, so he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he was wrestling with him. And Jacob, and the man says, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. He's still looking for the blessing, right? Still looking for the blessing. He stole it from his father, or from Esau, okay, through his father. He got the double portion as well, the double inheritance, which he hasn't claimed yet. And he's still looking for that blessing. I will not let you go unless you bless me. At this point, who does Jacob think that this person is? Like just some guy who showed up in the desert and started wrestling him? And he's like, I really want your blessing. So we're going to wrestle until you give me your blessing. Who does he think that this individual is? And so the individual responds, says to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he says, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. So Israel, the L on the end there is God, okay? Striving with Israel. So the man is claiming, the person, the individual is claiming, you're wrestling with God right now. And Jacob, suddenly light bulb goes off on his head, and he calls the place of the name in verse 30, Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been delivered. And he was limping from that point on. So there's something that's really illustrative about him limping along for the rest of his life in remembrance of what happened here. Yeah. Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. Birthright is a tangible physical, you get a double portion. So when I write up my will, you get twice what the other brother gets as a birthright. The blessing is not physical, like I will give you this amount of wealth. It's we talked about this a little bit before in another session. It's almost like a prophecy that's given over them to say, this will be what will happen to you, right? The blessing is what everybody is trying to get back to after the fall. The blessing, all that a blessing in terms of just a general sense, blessing is only to say, let's get back to what how it was supposed to be, right? Because after the fall, now I have struggle, I have suffering, I have put my seed in the ground and it dies, I have curse. And so I'm trying to get back to the blessing of before the fall. So there's something that is, it's hard to understand, but it seems like it's efficacious in some way that the Father pronounces blessing, and it's an expected thing. Like I will pronounce blessing on usually my oldest is what we're expecting upon my oldest to say, you will be, God's going to have favor upon you. So it's not a physical, tangible thing like the birthright is. But he views it as more important.
So maybe that's why Esau gave up his birthright so easily.
Yeah, right. Exactly, right. Yeah. And Esau is also willing to kill Jacob over the blessing, not over the birthright. He's probably angry over the birthright, but it doesn't matter that much to him. It's a complete difference from what we would say today, right? The physical inheritance, or like there's something of value there, something good that's there, blessing not so much. But we see the blessing that occurs again and again. And when we get to Genesis 49, that's what Genesis 49, Jacob's blessing is called to his children. And he goes through the list of the tribes. And he says, here's you, here's you, here's you. But it's not blessing in the same way. In fact, a good amount of it is not blessing. So that'll be like a switch when we get to 49. Yeah. So Jacob still wants this blessing from this individual. You have the name change, and we always want to pay attention to a name change. Abram to Abraham, Sarai to Sarah. We have several different name changes as we go through. Isaac receives his name, Yitzhak, laughter, before, and his name is not changed. But Jacob's name is now changed at this point to Israel. But I want you also to take a look at chapter 35. Chapter 35, this is very interesting to me. We would expect in chapter 32, God changes Jacob's name to Israel. In chapter 35, starting in verse 9, it says, God appeared to Jacob again when he came to him from Paddan, or when he came from Paddan Aram, and he blessed him. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. And he reiterates to him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful, a nation will come from you, kings will come from you. The land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give it to you and to your seed after you. So his name is changed twice, Jacob to Israel. Why is it necessary that I have a second instance of God declaring to Jacob, Jacob, your name is changed? Right? Your name is moved from Jacob now to Israel. Why do I have that? It's very interesting to me. I think that there is, there's always a correlation when a name change takes place, right? God has the ability, even going all the way back, let's say to Adam, right? Where Adam names the animals. It's demonstrating authority over, right? It's saying, I have the responsibility of, or I am demonstrating or declaring what the name of this animal, individual, whatever that it is, right? Children name their parents, or excuse me, the other way around. Parents name their children. Children do name their parents, but in a different way. But you have a name change is a demonstration of a switch, or what should be a switch in that person's life. You were called this, now you're called this for a new reason, new identity, if you will. Okay, so Jacob wrestles with God, and from that story, we get this idea of Israel, and God says, you're no longer Jacob, but Israel, but then renames him again in chapter 35. Why? I think it's a reiteration to Jacob. You're a different person. Act like a different person. Okay, I'm naming you something different. Act like a different person than what you've been. You have an interesting statement in Genesis 15 about Abraham. It says, Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. You're like, that's when Abraham is saved. At whatever point that is, okay, there's a question when exactly that is from Genesis. Is it a more of a general statement or right specifically when that story is taking place? All of that aside, there's this statement. Abraham is credited righteousness because of his faith. If you were to ask, when is Jacob saved? Like, I see a progression in his life from really not great to eventually doing some things that are good, okay, that are correct. Let's take a look at, let me talk about chapter 34, and then I'm going to emphasize 35, okay? But 34, This is after Jacob and Esau have, in a sense, kind of settled their accounts. And Jacob makes camp in Shechem. And Shechem, we don't know how big the city was or how numerous that it was, but the city is named Shechem. The king who is there, his son's name is Shechem, apparently named the city after his son. We've seen that before. And that son, whose name is Shechem, an atrocious individual who rapes Dinah. Okay, and you have this instance of the people of Shechem say, why don't you just come join us, right? Shechem, the son, says, I'll marry Dinah. Why don't you just come with us? We'll join forces. You're wealthy. We've got some wealth. We have protection. We whatever that it is. Let's join forces. And we're like, where have we heard this before? Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in Genesis. Those who would syncretize with those around them in Canaan. But before Jacob can say, oh yes or oh no, Simeon and Levi, that's the second and third born, right, of Leah, they form a plot. And they say, you defiled our sister. Their plot is, we're going to kill everybody in Shechem. We're going to kill all the men in Shechem. And they do so. Okay, they wipe out all the men in Shechem. And there's this really interesting interaction between Jacob and Simeon and Levi. And he says, you've made us an odor to the people around. Right? Everybody is going to be not trusting of us. And they said, like, what else were we supposed to do? Right? Our sister was defiled. What else are we supposed to do? They could have done a lot of other things, but they reacted and killed everybody in Shechem. So Jacob, for that story, Jacob kind of takes a back seat, right? He kind of takes a back seat to everything that went on. Is that a positive view of Jacob? Not really. Okay, again, he doesn't step out and do what he's supposed to do or react in a particular way that he's supposed to react. But I want you to take a look at chapter 35. Chapter 35, verse 1. Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel. Okay, that's where he was when he had the vision. And live there. Make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. So Jacob and his household and all who are with him, or so Jacob said to his household and all those who are with him, put away the foreign gods which are among you and cleanse yourselves. There is a breath of fresh air. There is a breath of fresh air when it comes to the patriarch of the family taking a stand and saying, get rid of the idols. How long have they been carrying them? A really, really long time. I think it's interesting. There's kind of an underlying tone through many different portions of Scripture of people carrying idols along with them when they're not or when they're supposed to be following after Yahweh. The Egyptians are full of idols. The Israelites leave Egypt by signs and wonders such as we have not ever seen ourselves. And the whole time they're crossing the Red Sea, they've got idols in their pockets. Their mules are loaded down with idols from Egypt. And they carry idols with them all the way through. They go into the land. The whole time that they're in the wilderness, 40 years. You're like, if there's ever a point where you want to lose a little bit of weight, okay, is wandering for 40 years in the wilderness. Carry them with them. Keep them on their pack mules. Carry them in their backpack. Keep them with them the whole time. They cross the Jordan River. They go into the land of Canaan. They fight wars. They fight all of these battles, see amazing things that happen, Yahweh delivering them, Yahweh saving them. Joshua comes to the end and says, hey guys, I'm about to die. You probably want to get rid of your idols now. And they say, oh sure, we'll do it. We'll do that. We'll get rid of our idols. Not a problem. Joshua dies. What do? Keep their idols. Then we go into the book of Judges, and we know what happens there. Okay, same kind of idea right here. How long have idols been a part of Jacob's family? How long have they been carrying them along with them? Years and years and years. Okay, so finally we see a breath of fresh air. Verse 2, put away the foreign gods which are among you. Cleanse yourselves, change your garments. Let us arise and go up to Bethel. I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods which they had and the rings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was near Shechem. Okay, so they're leaving Shechem now. He buries them, and then they journeyed on. Okay, so Jacob finally takes a stand, says what's right, leads his family in the right way, says, we're going to go up to worship Yahweh. I'm going to make an altar there. And he leads in terms of worshiping Yahweh as he should have from the beginning. And it's right after that, at least in the text that we have here, 35 verse 9, God appears to Jacob again. And God says to him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. Don't call yourself Jacob anymore. Call yourself Israel. Okay, you're a different person. Call yourself Israel. Different identity. Okay. There's a little bit left, of course. We haven't come to the death of Jacob yet. Notice especially chapter 36, the generations of Esau. We talked about that a little bit before. But chapter 36, generations of Esau, in terms of what generations are listed, Esau becomes very great. Lots of princes, lots of leaders come from him. Okay, and Edom and Israel are always fighting back and forth. If you want the prophecy concerning Edom, take a look at the tiny little book of Obadiah, right, in the Minor Prophets. So next time, we're going to look at the sons of Jacob. And it lists them out there towards the end of chapter 35. And you see all the way in chapter 35, verse 28, now we have Isaac die. The days of Isaac were 180 years. And so we go through all of this story. Isaac's expecting to die like at any time. He lives for another 43 years. Finally, in verse 28 of chapter 35, all the days of Isaac were 180. And he breathed his last, and he was gathered to his people. And both of his sons, Esau and Jacob, buried him. Okay, so next time we're going to talk about the sons of Jacob. What decisions are they making? How are they resembling old dad and old grandpa and an old great-grandpa? How are they interacting with this promise, thinking about this promise? Okay, so we'll take a look at that next time. But let me open it up for questions. Isaac, Jacob, Esau, yeah. Yeah.
And it says in verse 8
at the end. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I've read this throughout the entire Old Testament.
Yeah.
David says it.
Right.
Isaac says it.
Right.
I mean, you have all the men of God that say that same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And so I was thinking, well, one of two things.
Yeah. Yeah.
A resurrection type of thing.
Okay.
I don't want to reach too much into it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought that sounded good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. I wouldn't reach too far into it just because we want to be careful not to go too far with the text or not miss things in the text as well, right? So there's this balance. How do I know exactly what the text is saying? But what I would do in terms of like understanding what that idea is conveying is say, what's all the times in which it's mentioned? And it's always in terms of someone who dies gathered to their people. So I would see, it's an interesting metaphor that's used, right? Because someone being gathered together with other people means an individual going into a group. And you're like, he's dying, and he's going to go to a group. So what's the group referring to? I would probably take it just as Sheol, like he's going down into Sheol, into the grave. Sheol's just a very general term, right? Going down into the grave. So I would take it that way, but it's still a very interesting metaphor that's used, right? Gather to your people. Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's good. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're traditional.
Yep.
They're not Americanized.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they are expected, the men are expected
yeah.
to live in the family home
yeah.
until they get married.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So we laugh now.
Yeah.
We say, oh, he was 70 years old.
Right. Right.
But where would they go?
No, that's... Exactly right. Right. That's exactly right. They were supposed to live at home, right? And even this statement in Genesis, right? A man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, right? So he's not supposed to leave and like make his own fortune elsewhere or anything like that. So I'm poking fun because he's 77 when he gets married. But you're exactly right, right? They're supposed to stay at home until they get married. And that's the whole, like, arranged marriages, right? A whole idea of arranged marriages. Parents are choosing in that culture. So the woman stays at home as well, just like the man does, until it's arranged. And then they say, arranged, you marry you, and then they come together and form their own family unit. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
When it comes to the tolerance of idols,
yeah.
Yahweh says, like, you'll have no gods before me.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
When he comes down, he like grinds it up and makes
yeah.
drink the water.
Uh-huh. Right.
Why was the golden calf not tolerated, but the other gods were?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good question, right? Why are other gods tolerated to a certain extent? It's the syncretism. As their Sinai is one of those instances where they are like God is right there. They can see the glory. They can like they're standing far back from the mountain. And even the people say, like, we cannot go near this mountain. We can't touch it. They're trembling. They're afraid for their lives. And they still build an idol. And it's like, how, like, what kind of disparate or broken thinking is there? That, like, here he is, but yet I still want to create an idol. Like, why would you do that? So it's such a pronounced period that Moses, just in anger, in a righteous anger, grinds it up, makes them drink it. And so the same is said, should be said, of all the idols. Like, that's don't have any idols before me. It doesn't change over time. But I think Sinai is such a, like, a pointed example of it. It's just they're tolerated, you know, for a long, long time. What's really interesting is that by the time you get to Jesus, you have idols as an issue all the way through the Old Testament, right? The entire way through the Old Testament, idols, 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 idols. By the time you get to Jesus, there's no idols, right? The Pharisees are not like struggling with idols. They're struggling with legalism, right? Which is the opposite side. So it's interesting, that relationship. There's a lot to study there. Did you have a question? No. Okay. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, right. There's no scripture, like those who you bless, I will bless, curse, but there's no scripture there's nothing wrong with Isaac blessing Esau in terms of a general blessing, right? There's nothing wrong with him doing that. The promise is to say that Jacob or Esau is going to serve Jacob. Right? I'm choosing Jacob over Esau. And so Isaac should have recognized that. He should have understood that, and he should have acted according to it. Right? But the fact that his favorite is Esau, for whatever reason, he wants to bless Esau with the blessing instead of Jacob. So it's not how he should have done things, but there's no like scriptural reference that I can think of that's like a command, like do not bless anyone other than, you know, yeah. A blessing is supposed to go across the board. Like, I'll bless all the families of the earth, right? So the idea of blessing is let's bring back to the way things should be, right, before they're broken. Yeah. Leo. Yeah.
You know, suggestion. It's just, in the Middle East, it's everything right from this story, because every nation, every tribe, everybody followed the tribal, you know, the tribal leader.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all the monotheistic religions, they follow so many exact tradition that the Jewish people doesn't. Even in the Muslim world, people don't realize it, but it's exact same rituals and exact same thing. Even, let's say, if they want to bless a house, they need to do a sacrifice of an animal or a chicken, and then they put the blood on the house.
Yeah.
Eastern Orthodox churches, they follow actual, like almost, you know, exact process and ritual. Like they close, they have to close the altar. Okay, there's a time, like 40 days during the Easter, they have to close it.
Yeah.
Only the high priest can go back in there.
Yeah.
So all these Eastern things, and then the way they wear their clothes, everything is through those traditions.
Yeah.
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 And then the tribalism is like, even now today, you have tribes that any issue that goes on, any legal situation, has to go to the head of the tribe. He's the one has to say yes or nay. Blood for blood. It's still in there, happening in Africa, in the Middle East. So.
Next week, Leo's teaching on cultural references in the Old Testament. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
For Isaac, I don't think indirectly is there any reference that he had any harm to God.
That he, right, exactly. He did not. Right? Of the three, there's no reference that Isaac had any concubine or had handmaid of Rebekah, and she would have brought handmaids with her. Right? At least one. Yeah.
I can see it. Yeah. God is showing us how men are supposed to be.
Yeah. 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 Yes. Yes. I wouldn't say that's reading too much into the text. I do think God, in selecting, there's a special, like, God is choosing very interesting individuals, not always good, but very interesting individuals to say you are in the line of Christ. Like, think about Rahab. Think about Ruth. Think about, like, these are the stories to help us understand how is God bringing about his promise. And there's honor, like very similar to, you know, honor given to Mary, right? The mother of Christ. There's honor that's given there. Leah has that honor. God selects her to have that honor. Yeah. 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 Right. Right. Now Rachel with Joseph, she has Joseph, you know, the tribe, there's no tribe of Joseph, right? It's split into two. It has a very prominent place. Joseph does have a very prominent place. And Benjamin as well. I mean, in terms, you know, Saul is first king, comes from Benjamin. So there's not great stories about Benjamin in Judges, but they're still prominent. They are still prominent, but Judah in particular for Leah is an honor.
And one last question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They have something tangible to it.
Yeah.
So the fact that Jacob was limping.
Yeah.
Is it a transformation of a
character
to perform? You don't go by your own means.
Yeah.
You have to be leaning on me.
Yeah.
And I will guide you. Because he had the desire to follow God.
Right.
And I mean, just for me, it's very intriguing
that
he wanted the blessing. He wanted to be part of the promise.
Yeah.
And is it kind of like God showing you not going to deal with the manipulation?
It's a very good question. We want to ask, hopefully I'm going to explain this because it helps us understand how to study the Bible, right? Not just that one example, but how to study the Bible. We would hold, of course, that everything within the Bible is intentional, right? So all the stories, they're exactly historical, but they're intentional. So when we get to a story like Jacob wrestling with God, and it says that God, or you know, the individual touched Jacob's hip, you're like, that's a description of what happened, but why was, like, why that? Why not, like, touch his arm and put his arm out of socket? Or why, like, why the hip in particular? So there's intention behind it. So the first thing that we want to do is recognize and ask the good question. What happened here? And then why is there intention behind it? There's a purposeful selection of it. The issue where we come into with biblical studies is not trying to force our why onto the text. So we can have a question, okay, why would God choose to cause Jacob to limp for the rest of his life? And we could come up with some different ideas, but do recognize, first of all, that it's intentional, right? Jacob limping for the rest of his life is something that God intentionally did to him. Then we ask the question, why, right? Could we pull on his character and say, well, because he was trying to do everything on his own strength, and now he's got a reminder in his crooked leg or broken leg or whatever that is, like, hey, you can't do this on your own. Yes, I think we can say that, but there's going to be some debate, right? But in terms of biblical study, first, it's recognizing what happened here, and then recognizing this is intentional, whatever it is, it's intentional, then asking the question, what does that mean? What's the significance of it? Okay, other questions? Yes, sir? Yes. Yeah. It's a very good question. Could there have been a different way that Jacob received the blessing, right? When God made the promise that Esau was going to serve Jacob, right? The older will serve the younger. When God makes that promise, even we saw back in the life of Abraham, God makes a promise and he keeps that promise. And so whatever promise it is that God makes, he will keep. The problem is when an individual tries to come in and make something happen. Right, so Abraham doesn't have a son. Sarah doesn't have a son. So, well, let's use Hagar and make God's promise happen. Jacob does the same thing, right? You say, if he's listening to his mother, say, God promised that you're going to be blessed. And he says, oh, well, let me make it happen, right? God absolutely would have and could have blessed him in a better way than him stealing the blessing. But God used it and worked through it. So you see the individual who's saying, I'm going to make it happen, right? Let me do it. And then you see God, in spite of that individual's poor decisions, God working through it to make it happen for what he wants to do. Yeah.
Yeah, just to kind of add to what you're saying, it's really fascinating to see the sovereignty of God.
Yeah.
Kind of in the midst of all this.
Yeah.
It's like God doesn't coerce or force or
yeah.
make a person be like a robot.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Right. The sovereignty of God is on vivid display in Genesis. When we get to the end, Joseph makes a very famous statement, what you intended for poor, God intended for good to bring this about, right? So everything that we see, it's a narrative, it's a story, it's a description, but everything's intentional and God's in control of everything too. It's very good. Yes, sir. Yeah.
That's all God has to work with in my life. Are crooked lines. So he makes my crooked lines straight lines.
Praise the Lord. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, exactly right. Very good. All right, next time we'll come back. We'll take a look at the life of Joseph, a very interesting individual as well. And we'll carry on. Next week is our last week too. So don't miss it, okay? All right, I'll see you next week.